From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
What the administration has said is that when it comes to national security, the problem is that the Democrats have a pre-9/11 view of the world. But let me tell you what I think the problem is. The real problem is that the president seems to have a pre-1776 view of the world.
Senators question Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez over the Bush administration's right to spy on American citizens without court order. Then Muslim protests continue to rage around the world against the cartoons of Prophet Muhammad.
Freedom of speech does not mean insult. There is a thin fine line on that. So have to be careful when attacking someone's religion.
Today, a debate. And today is the funeral of Coretta Scott King. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Washington, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee and defended the Bush administration's decision to carry out warrantless domestic eavesdropping. Gonzalez insisted the program was legal and necessary, and that mostly only Americans calling associates of al-Qaeda have been affected. But both Republican and Democratic senators raised numerous concerns over the surveillance. When asked why the president never went to Congress, Gonzalez said, quote, "The short answer is we didn't think we needed to, quite frankly." Republican Senator Lindsey Graham responded by saying, quote, "In all honesty, Mr. Attorney General, the argument you're making is very dangerous." This is Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy.
The president and the Justice Department have a constitutional duty to faithfully execute the laws. They do not write the laws. They do not pass the laws. They do not have unchecked powers to decide what laws to follow, and they certainly don't have the power to decide what laws to ignore. They cannot violate the laws or the rights of ordinary Americans. Mr. Attorney General, in America, our America, nobody is above the law, not even the President of the United States.
A new critic of the domestic spying program has also emerged, former President Jimmy Carter. He described the Bush administration's decision to go ahead with the warrantless spying as, quote, disgraceful and illegal. Carter said, quote, "No one knows how many innocent Americans have had their privacy violated under this secret act." Carter made the announcement in Nevada at an event where his son Jack announced he's running for the U.S. Senate. Meanwhile, USA Today is reporting the National Security Agency has secured the cooperation of AT&T, MCI, and Sprint, and other large telecommunications companies to eavesdrop without warrant on international calls. Last week, the Electronic Frontier Foundation sued AT&T for its suspected involvement. We'll have more on the domestic spying in a few minutes. In Haiti, voters are heading to the polls today in the first presidential election since the U.S.-backed ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide nearly 2 years ago. The election's taking place after being postponed four times. An ally of Aristide, former President René Préval, is expected to win today's election but falls short of enough votes to prevent a runoff. Préval served as Aristide's first prime minister, then succeeded him as president in 1996. Aristide once famously called Préval his Marasa, or twin. However, Préval never joined Aristide's political party, Lavalas. He has said he would not prevent Aristide's return to Haiti. On Monday, one of the most influential supporters of Aristide, the Catholic priest, Father Gerard Jean-Juste, threw his support behind Préval. Polls show no critic of Aristide gained much more than 10% of the vote. A factory owner named Charles-Henri Baker is polling second. He was a leader of the anti-Aristide group of 184 and is the only white candidate in the race. He's been accused of running sweatshops. Muslims across the globe are continuing to stage protests over the publication of cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in the European press. In Iran, demonstrators storm the Danish embassy in Tehran. In Afghanistan, protesters attack the officers of Norwegian NATO troops. In Chechnya, the government has banned Danish humanitarian organizations from working in the region. We'll have a debate on the protests later in the program. President Bush has released his proposed nearly $28 trillion budget for next year that features major increases in defense spending, but deep cuts in Medicare and other domestic social programs. Under the proposed budget, defense spending will increase nearly 7% to $440 billion. If approved, the Pentagon's budget will be 45% larger than when Bush took office 5 years ago. The military spending is actually far higher because the proposed budget does not include the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One recent estimate put the cost of the Iraq war at $100,000 per minute. At the same time, the president's proposing to make his tax cuts permanent. This would cost about $1.5 trillion over the next decade. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld discussed the budget on Monday.
The president's budget request for the Department of Defense represents an increase over last year. It reflects what we should believe should be the country's national security priorities, namely to help defend the United States of America and the American people and their interests, to give flexibility to commanders to prepare for both conventional and unconventional or irregular warfare, and importantly, to work closely with partner nations to help them develop the capabilities needed to defeat terrorists within their borders and to cooperate with us and other countries with respect to this global threat.
While the Pentagon budget is soaring, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities warns President Bush is proposing to make cuts in hundreds of domestic programs. This includes education programs, environmental protection programs, numerous programs to assist low-income families, children, and elderly and disabled people, and research related to cancer, heart disease, and other medical conditions. In one case, the center estimates 420,000 low-income seniors will lose food assistance from the Commodity Supplemental Food Program. Democratic and even some Republican lawmakers have criticized the president for proposing to slash spending on social programs. Republican Senator Arlen Specter called Bush's proposed cuts in education and health, quote, scandalous, while Republican Senator Olympia Snowe said she's, quote, disappointed and even surprised at the extent of the administration's proposed cuts in Medicaid and Medicare. And a correction, President Bush has released his proposed budget of nearly $2.8 trillion. On the military front, the budget also calls for $27 million to help jumpstart the country's first new nuclear weapons program in 20 years. The money will be used to fund a competition between the Los Alamos and the Lawrence Livermore Labs to find and design a new generation of nuclear bombs to replace the country's entire nuclear arsenal. Last week, the nation's top nuclear weapons executive, Linton Brooks, said, quote, "We're on the verge of an exciting time." Parts of the budget have not been well received in the Gulf Coast region affected by Hurricane Katrina. Mississippi Democratic Congressmember Benny Thompson criticized President Bush for proposing to make cuts to a grant program that helps state and local authorities deal with evacuations, mass casualties, and managing catastrophes. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, the city's mayor, Ray Nagin, has publicly admitted he may begin seeking international aid to help rebuild the city because the federal government has been so slow in funding the reconstruction. On Friday, Nagin met with a French delegation and said, quote, "I know we had a little disappointment earlier with some signals we're getting from Washington, but the international community may be able to fill the gap." King Abdullah of Jordan also visited New Orleans on Friday. In business news, the Japanese company Toshiba has bought nuclear power plant manufacturer Westinghouse for $5.4 billion, a price tag three times higher than expected. The high price reflects a renewed interest by Asian governments and the Bush administration to build a new generation of nuclear power plants. One energy analyst said, quote, "We're seeing an indication of a nuclear power renaissance globally and in particular in the U.S. China plans to build 27 new nuclear reactors over the next 15 years. And here in the United States, President Bush has proposed spending $250 million next year on a new nuclear fuel reprocessing initiative to encourage the construction of the first new plants in a generation. In news from Washington, President Bush has announced he'll nominate a telecommunications lobbyist to fill a vacancy on the Federal Communications Commission. The lobbyist is named Robert McDowell. He's been working for a trade organization called CompTel that represents phone carriers that compete with the regional bell companies. According to the publication Communications Daily, McDowell has strong Republican ties and worked with FCC Commissioner Kevin Martin on the 2000 Florida vote recount. McDowell is also close to the Republican National Committee Chair, Ken Melman. Once confirmed, McDowell will give Republicans a majority on the FCC, at which time Chair Kevin Martin is expected to try again to rewrite the nation's media ownership laws. And in Cuba, 138 huge black flags have been placed in front of the U.S. diplomatic mission in Havana. The Cuban government said the flags pay honor to what they describe as Cuban victims of U.S.-backed terrorism. The flags will also block the U.S. government from operating an electronic news ticker from its window. On Monday, protesters also held up 138 photographs of the 73 victims of the 1976 plane explosion. Cuba's been calling on the U.S. to extradite the alleged mastermind of that attack, Luis Posada Carriles, to stand trial in Venezuela. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee and strongly defended the National Security Agency's domestic spy program. Gonzalez, who was the only witness at yesterday's hearing, insisted Congress gave President Bush the power to wiretap without a warrant when it passed a resolution giving the president authority to use force to combat terrorism after the September 11th attacks. Before being appointed Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez served as White House counsel from 2001 to 2005. He was instrumental in developing the legal justification for the spy program. Though Gonzalez came under tough questioning from both Republican and Democratic senators, he repeatedly declined to answer specific questions or give examples of how the program had protected the country. Gonzalez claimed this was classified information and disclosure would put individuals at risk. Monday's hearing got off to a testy start when some Democrats on the committee asked that Gonzalez be sworn in before his testimony. The Republican chair of the committee, Arlen Specter, declared it wasn't necessary and allowed the hearings to proceed without a swearing in. Today, we'll play excerpts of the hearings. Senator Arlen Specter started the questioning by asking why the administration insists on bypassing FISA court, which has the power to legally authorize government wiretaps.
Mr. Attorney General, starting with the FISA court, well-respected, maintained secrecy, experienced in the field, and I pose this question to you in my letter, why not take your entire program to the FISA court within the broad parameters of what is reasonable and constitutional and ask the FISA court to approve it or disapprove it?
Senator, I totally agree with you that the FISA court should be commended for its great service. They are working on weekends or working at nights.
Now on to my question.
There were assisting us in the war on terror. In terms of why not go to the FISA court, once the determination was made that neither the Constitution nor FISA prohibited the use of this tool, then the question becomes for the commander-in-chief, which of the tools is appropriate given a particular circumstance? And we study very carefully the requirements of the Constitution under the Fourth Amendment. We study very carefully what FISA provides for. As I said in my statement, we believe that FISA does anticipate that another statute could permit electronic surveillance.
Okay, you think you're right, but there are a lot of people who think you're wrong. As a matter of public confidence, why not take it to the FISA court? What do you have to lose if you're right?
What I can say, Senator, is that we are continually looking at ways that we can work with the FISA court in being more efficient and more effective in fighting the war on terror. Obviously, we would consider and are always considering methods of fighting the war effectively against al-Qaeda.
Well, speaking for myself, I would urge the president to take this matter to the FISA court. They're experts. They'll maintain the secrecy. And let's see what they have to say. Mr. Attorney General, did Judge Robertson of the FISA court resign in protest because of this program?
I do not know why Judge Robertson resigned, sir.
Has the FISA court declined to consider any information obtained from this program when considering warrants?
Sir, what I can say is that the sources of information provided or included in our application are advise or disclose to the FISA court, because obviously one of the things they have to do is judge the reliability.
So if you have information that you're submitting to the FISA court in support for a warrant, you tell them that it was obtained from this program?
Senator, I am uncomfortable talking about how this in great detail about how this information is generally shared. What I can say, as I just repeat what I just said, and that is, we, as a matter of routine, provide to the FISA court information about the sources of the information that form the basis of an application.
So I'm not asking you how you get the information from the program. I'm asking you, do you tell the FISA court that you got it from the program? I want to know if they are declining to issue warrants because they are dissatisfied with the program.
Senator, I'm not... I believe that getting into those kind of details is getting into the detail about how the program is operated. Obviously, the members of the court understand that the existence of this program. What I can say is we have a very open and very candid discussion and relationship with the FISA court. To the extent that we're involved in intelligence activities that relate any way to the FISA court and they have questions about that, we have discussions with the FISA court. Our relationship with the court is extremely important, and we do everything that we can do to assure them with respect to our intelligence activities that affect decisions that they make.
I'm not going to press you further, but I'd ask you to reconsider your answer.
That was Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter questioning Attorney General Berto Gonzalez. Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold also pointed questions of Gonzalez and accused him of lying under oath during his nomination hearings to become Attorney General.
Your arguments, but I want to get back to your testimony, which frankly, Mr. Attorney General, anybody that reads it basically realizes you were misleading this committee. You could have answered the question truthfully. You could have told the committee that, yes, in your opinion, the president has that authority by simply saying the truth, that you believe the president has the power to wiretap Americans without a warrant, would not have exposed any classified information. And my question wasn't whether such illegal wiretapping was going on. Like almost everyone in Congress, I didn't know, of course, about the program then. It wasn't even about whether the administration believed that the president has this authority. It was a question about your view of the law, about your view of the law, during a confirmation on your nomination to be Attorney General. So, of course, if you had told the truth, maybe that would have jeopardized your nomination. You wanted to be confirmed. And so you let a misleading statement about one of the central issues of your confirmation, your view of executive power, stay on the record until the New York Times revealed the program.
Senator, I told the truth then. I'm telling the truth now. You asked about a hypothetical situation of the President of the United States authorizing electronic surveillance in violation of our criminal statutes. That has not occurred.
Mr. Chairman, I think the witness has taken mincing words to a new high. There's no question in my mind that when you answered the question that was a hypothetical, you knew it was not a hypothetical, and you were under oath at the time.
That was Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy posed some of the toughest questions to Gonzalez.
Apparently, then according to your interpretation, Congress, and a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats disagree with you on this, when we voted for the authorization for military force, that we're authorizing warrantless wiretapping. Were we authorizing you to go into people's medical records here in the United States by your interpretation?
Senator, whatever the limits of the president's authority given by under the authorization to use military force and his inherent authority as commander-in-chief in a time of war, it clearly includes the electronic surveillance of the enemy.
Just let it note that you did not answer my question, but here you also said, we've had discussions with the Congress in the past, certain members of Congress, as to whether or not FISA could be amended to allow us to adequately deal with this kind of threat. We're advised that that would be difficult, if not impossible. That's your statement. All right. Who told you that?
Senator, there was discussion with a bipartisan group of Congress, leaders in Congress, leaders of the Intel Committee, to talk about legislation, and the consensus was that obtaining such legislation, the legislative process is such that it could not be successfully accomplished without compromising
the
program.
When did they give you that advice?
So that was sometime in 2004.
Oh, 3 years later. I mean, you've been doing this wiretapping for 3 years, and then they suddenly you come up here and say, oh, by the way, guys, could we have a little bit of authorization for this? Is that what you're saying?
Sir, it's always been our position that the president has the authority under the authorization to use military force.
It's always been your position. But frankly, it flies in the face of the statute, Mr. Attorney General, and I doubt very much if one single person in Congress would have known that was your position had you not known the newspapers were going to print what you were doing. Not that anybody up here knew it. When you found out the newspaper was going to print it, you came up here. Did you talk to any member of the Judiciary Committee that would actually write it? And let me ask you this. Did any member of this committee, this Judiciary Committee, asked to write the law, did anybody here tell you we couldn't write a law that would allow you to go after Al-Qaeda in the way you're talking about?
Sir, I don't believe there were any discussions with any members of the Judiciary Committee.
Well, even though we're the ones that have to write the law, and you're saying that you were told by members of Congress we couldn't write a law that would fit it, and now you tell us that the committee that has to write the law never was asked.
We had discussions.
Does this sound like a CYA on your part? It does to me.
We had discussions with a bipartisan leadership of the Congress about this program.
But none from this committee. We have both Republicans and Democrats on this committee, you know.
Yes, sir, I do know that.
And this committee has given you twice under my chairmanship, we have given you 5 amendments to FISA because you requested it. But this, you never came to us. Mr. Attorney General, can you see why I have every reason to believe we never would have found out about this if the press hadn't? Now, it's been talk about, well, let's go prosecute the press. Heavens. Thank God we have a press at least tells us what the heck you guys are doing. Because you're obviously not telling us.
Sir, we have advised bipartisan leadership of the Congress and the Intel committees about this program.
Well, did you tell them that before the passage of the USA Patriot Act?
Sir, I don't recall when the first briefing occurred. But it was my recollection is it was shortly after the program was initiated.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. You said several years after it started, you came up here and talked to some group of members of Congress. The press report said that the president's program of spying on Americans without warrants was shut down for some time in 2004. That sounds like the time you were up here. If the president believed the program was necessary and legally justified, why did he cut it? Why did he shut it down?
Sir, you're asking me about the operations of the program.
Of course. I'm sorry, Mr. Attorney General. I forgot you can't answer any questions that might be relevant to this. Well, if the president has that authority, does he also have the authority to wiretap Americans' domestic calls and emails under this? Let me finish. Under this authority, if he feels it involves Al-Qaeda activity. I'm talking about within this country, under this authority you've talked about, does he have the power, under your authority, to wiretap Americans within the United States if they're involved in Al-Qaeda activity?
Sir, I've been asked this question several times.
I know, and you've had somewhat of a vague answer, so I'm asking again.
And I've said that presents a different legal question, a tough, possibly tough constitutional question. And I am not comfortable just off the cuff talking about whether or not such activity would in fact be constitutional. I will say that is not what we're talking about here. That is
are you
not
doing
what
that?
The president has authorized.
Yeah, are you doing that?
I can't give you assurances. That is not what the president has authorized.
Are you doing that
with this program?
Are you doing that,
Senator? You're asking me again about operations. Okay. What are we doing?
Thank you.
Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy questioning Attorney General Berto Gonzalez at Monday's hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back to discuss the latest. Stay with us. Watching me.
before I close my eyes at night. I think, sense, feel, man, like I'm under some kind of microscope. Satellites over my head, transmitters in my dollars, hawking, watching, scoping, shocking, scrutinizing me, checking to see what I'm doing, where I be, who I see, how and where and with whom I make my money. What is this? Excuse me, miss, may I have your phone number and your social security? Who, me? When all I came to do was buy my double or triple A batteries, please, I decline.
Jill Scott watching me here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. To discuss the hearings, we're joined by Aziz Huq. He is the associate counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law, co-writing a book entitled Unchecked and Unbalanced with Fritz Schwartz on National Security and the Separation of Powers. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be here, Amy.
Can you just start off responding to this hearing and what you thought was most significant as we watched and listened to some of these senators questioning the Attorney General?
Amy, the most significant thing that we heard in yesterday's hearing was the Attorney General's assertion of what he thinks the president can do as a result of the authorization for the use of military force that was passed on September the 14th, 2001. And essentially what the Attorney General was saying and implying was that the president can do whatever he feels is necessary to win a fairly uncabined version of a war on terror. And the most important thing that we didn't hear were really any factual details about quite who the NSA is spying on, quite where that information is going, and quite how the NSA is determining its targets and managing and limiting its spying activity.
As you listen to the senators, one of the things that was interesting is a lot of Republicans joined in with the Democrats, among them Lindsey Graham, the Democrat of the Republican of South Carolina. And he went further. He said, do you believe it's lawful for Congress to say, to tell the government, you cannot abuse a prisoner of war? And Gonzalez said, I'm not prepared to say that. So why bother passing any laws after the after the September 14th, 2001 law? He's saying that it authorized everything.
I think that Senator Graham really hit the nail on the head there. Senator Graham has been key in sponsoring another very critical law, the McCain Anti-Torture Amendment, and is clearly concerned about whether the McCain Anti-Torture Amendment that was passed at the end of last year will have any legal binding effect on what the president authorizes his subordinates to do.
Explain that further.
Last year, Congress signed into law a restriction on cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment by employees and agents of the U.S. government. And in signing that law,
The McCain bill,
the president said that he would interpret it according to his constitutional prerogatives. Now, what Senator Graham was referring to today was the concern that Senator Graham has, that Senator McCain has, and that many on the other side of the House have, is that President Bush will be interpreting not just the authorization for the use of military force to authorize whatever he feels is necessary, but also as a license to restrict the limits that Congress has chosen to place on presidential activities in the counterterrorism arena, like the McCain Amendment.
Of course, he signed a side letter in that case, which also freed him further, the president. Yes, he made a big deal of signing the agreement and standing with Senator McCain, but then he signed a side letter that said, actually, he can do what he wants to do.
Right. The side letter you're referring to is the presidential signing statement. And signing statements are typically not seen as a source of interpretation of the law, except that is under a Justice Department interpretation that's been put forward or was put forward by Judge Alito in the mid-'80s.
How independent is the Attorney General supposed to be? I mean, to some watching yesterday, it looked like it was President Bush's personal attorney or the attorney for the White House, which, in fact, Alberto Gonzalez was before he became Attorney General.
That's right. The Attorney General at one point in the hearings referred to his client as the president, but really he's the Attorney General of the United States and represents the interests of the United States as a whole. And there's a long-standing tradition within the Justice Department of institutional continuity, of a loyalty to the institutions of the United States per se, rather than the political appointees who happen to be in them. And we've seen some indications that the Justice Department has veered somewhat from that tradition. We've seen it in the voting rights area. We've seen it in the positions taken in the counterterrorism area, in documents like the torture memo of 2002. So there is some concern, I would say, about the way in which the Justice Department is comporting itself professionally.
I mean, when Janet Reno was the Attorney General under President Clinton, it seems like he tried to get rid of her a number of times, not pleased with how she was dealing with certain issues, that there was a tension between the two.
Whereas today we have an Attorney General who's extremely close to his president, and I use the word his president.
Is he also protecting himself?
I think we don't know that until we see, as several of the senators said in yesterday's hearings, a lot more of the documents and a lot more of the basic facts.
Do you think that's going to happen?
I think we'll see a very hotly contested battle about the legal opinions, about the factual opinions in the forthcoming days. I think what we've seen in the press is the difficulty of keeping details of programs of this kind under wraps, particularly when within both the NSA and the CIA, you have a great deal of evident discontent about the way in which these agencies have been directed to act. And so if we see details of these programs come out, I think it's just as likely that they come out in the press as through congressional inquiries.
Is the Senate Judiciary Committee going to get any information on what, in fact, the Bush administration is doing, monitoring, surveilling, wiretapping Americans without court order?
Particularly if the Senate Judiciary Committee chooses to call former Justice Department officials like Deputy Attorney General Jim Comey, like the former head of the Office of Legal Counsel, Jack Goldsmith, that committee has a good chance of getting a meaningful cut at information about what the NSA is doing.
We had a guest on our show a month or two ago named Russell Tice, who had worked with the National Security Agency. He has told Congress he wants to testify.
I think having people like Mr. Tice, people like the other former NSA, current NSA employees who are covered by the federal whistleblower statute, who are protected from retribution from political superiors, come forward and testify, either in closed hearings or in open hearings. And with closed hearings, one can always issue a redacted manuscript or transcript after the hearing, would be a way for the Judiciary Committee to have some real oversight, the sort of oversight that Congress is expected to exercise over the NSA.
Do you think that these hearings are productive or bluster? They are good theater, but are the senators, the Democrats as well as the Republicans, getting anywhere?
Hearings are a way...
And what would they have to do to actually get information?
Hearings are a way of directing public attention to an issue. And to the extent that the hearing clarifies the issues at stake in the NSA program, these hearings are valuable. Now, whether they're the best way to get at the detailed facts about what the NSA has precisely been doing, and whether it's really this very targeted program that Attorney General Gonzalez describes, or whether it's the sort of dragnet data mining operation that doesn't rest on individual suspicion, that simply looks for people to spy on. That kind of question, I think, we'll only see through congressional investigations along the model of the Church Committee. We'll see through further news reporting.
Explain the Church Committee.
The Church Committee was a body set up by the Senate in 1975 to investigate overreaching by the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, and other intelligence agencies during the Cold War. They conducted a year-long investigation. They had subpoena power. What they produced at the end of that year was a multi-volume report that documented in exacting detail a gamut of overreaching abuses and political manipulation of intelligence agencies across both Democratic and Republican presidencies.
The ultimate clash here is the power of these two parts of the government, right? The executive and Congress. What do you think is going to come of this? It's happened in other times, too, and we're going to see this, but this overarching supremacy of the executive branch of government over legislative.
American history teaches us that there is a quick swing between presidential supremacy and congressional supremacy. If you look back to the Civil War, you have one of the most powerful presidents in history, Abraham Lincoln, followed by one of the first presidents to face impeachment, Andrew Johnson. If you look back at Watergate, the same is true. If you look back to Clinton, you see the same shift in power. Today's assertions of presidential supremacy aren't necessarily a lasting feature of the political landscape, and Congress certainly has the resources to cut back on it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Aziz Haque is associate counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, co-writing a book called Unchecked and Unbalanced on National Security and the Separation of Powers. Thanks so much for joining us. As we move on now to another major issue dominating the news, Muslims continuing to protest around the world over the publication of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. At least 6 people have been killed in the worldwide protests in Somalia, Lebanon, 4 people in Afghanistan. Violence has broken out in cities across Europe, the Middle East, and parts of Asia. The Danish newspaper that originally published the 12 cartoons last September, including one that shows the Prophet Muhammad wearing a turban shaped as a bomb with a burning fuse, the cartoons were republished in European and other news media in the last week. Muslims say the images are blasphemous and contrary to Islamic tradition, prohibiting depictions of the Prophet. The reaction to their publication has stretched across the globe. In Iran, Lebanon, Syria, the Danish embassies have been set ablaze, and several Middle Eastern countries have recalled their ambassadors from Denmark. The Iranian government said it's reviewing trade ties with all the countries where the cartoons have been published. Denmark issued a list of 14 Muslim countries which Danish travelers should avoid and urged its citizens on Tuesday to leave Indonesia. Some Muslim leaders have condemned the violence. This is Ahmed Abu Liaban, Imam of the Danish Muslim Society.
Our issue is intellectual and culture. In Sharia, what is happening is wrong. Somebody made cartoons, he should be, or this group or institution only should be held responsible about it. Setting fire to embassies, peaceful people, it's wrong. It's not acceptable in any terms. Moreover, Scandinavia have been very peaceful, cooperative, and helpful to the people in the Middle East and to the Palestinian issue. So I think this violence is completely wrong.
Meanwhile, fresh protests erupted in Pakistan and neighboring Afghanistan, where a NATO base used by Norwegian troops was attacked. On Monday, protesters turned out in Iraq, the West Bank, Turkey, Indonesia, India, Thailand, and even New Zealand. Newspapers have defended the publication of the cartoons, arguing their right to free speech. One protester in Auckland argued otherwise.
Freedom of speech does not mean insult. There is a thin fine line on that. So have to be careful when attacking someone's religion.
The Philadelphia Inquirer became the first U.S. newspaper to publish the disputed cartoons Saturday. The paper's editor, Amanda Bennett, said, quote, my view is that we need to publish it for a good news reason. We need to publish in context, and we need to explain to readers why we did it. In Washington, the Bush administration took a diplomatic approach to the issue. This is State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick.
We understood why many Muslims found the cartoons offensive. We found we talked about the fact that we found on Friday the cartoons offensive, but we also spoke out very clearly in support of freedom of the press as to what appears in newspapers, what is broadcast over the airwaves. Those are decisions in free countries for free media to.
State Department's Sean McCormick. When we come back from break, we'll have a debate on the cartoon controversy. Stay with us. Drummers of the Nile, Mahmoud Fadel, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we host a debate on the controversy over the cartoons depicting Prophet Muhammad and the worldwide protests, we're joined in the Yale studio in New Haven, Connecticut, by Irshad Manji. She is author of the book, The Trouble with Islam Today, A Muslim's Call for Reform in Her Faith, currently based at Yale as a visiting fellow with the International Security Studies Program. And on the phone with us from California is Asad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus, author of several books, his latest is The Battle for Saudi Arabia, Royalty, Fundamentalism, and Global Power. He also runs a popular blog called the Angry Arab News Service. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Asad Abu Khalil, can you respond to these worldwide protests against the publication of these cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad?
Well, I would try to explain some of the orientations of Muslim Arab angers about the cartoons. Before I do so, I would like to say right at the outset where I stand. First, I am very much in favor, and I relish the opportunity to mock every and other religion. What I think is very bothersome to many Arabs and Muslims is exactly what the other guest does, which is selective condemnation and mocking of one religion over others. I mean, I think if you mock a religion that is consistent, free-thinking, in support for the Enlightenment, as well as secularism, but what comes out of many in the West is selective secularism, the notion that you can mock one religion, but all others have to be treated with reverence and sacredness. And this is why this entire defense in the name of freedom of speech doesn't sell very much in the Arab world. People very much know that offenses against Muslims and Arabs are often treated as defensible because they are in the name of freedom of speech. And the Philadelphia Inquirer, which, among many other Western publications, circulated and reprinted those cartoons, again in the name of freedom of speech. And we all know that they wouldn't dare do so if these were offensive to Jews, for example. I mean, this entire debate about newsworthiness of those cartoons also is not very convincing. I mean, David Irving is a grotesque Nazi, white supremacist, so-called historian in England, was in trial. And I wouldn't think that the Philadelphia Inquirer would ever dare reprint some of his ugly, hateful writings about the Second World era. I mean, this shows exactly the kind of hypocrisy that is striking many in the Arab Muslim world. Hmm. The second thing I want to say is,
let me get Irshad Manji to respond, and then you can respond to her.
Well, thank you very much, Amy. I am frankly shocked that your other guest would already attack me for being quote-unquote selective. Certainly, I have written a book called The Trouble with Islam Today, but as I have pointed out time and again, that doesn't mean there are that the other religions are problem-free. It's just that there are no shortage of books in the libraries about the problem with Christianity, no dearth of books about the trouble within Judaism. It seems to me that we Muslims have a lot of catching up to do in the dissent department, and I think that a program like this very much appreciates the need for dissent of all belief systems. And speaking of dissent, you know, I find it interesting that your other guest suggests or actually emphasizes that there is a targeting of Islam, but that no other religion, you know, can be mocked. That how then does he explain the routinely and viciously anti-Semitic programming that comes out of the Arab world? And I would remind him that we Muslims never protest that kind of atrocity. So how do we have integrity demanding to the rest of the world that they completely respect our religion when we ourselves have trouble respecting other faiths?
Assad Abu Khalil.
Well, I mean, that's very easy to respond to. I mean, first of all, I am aware of the pontification of the other guest on Fox News, among other outlets that relish the opportunity to have somebody like her.
I'll let CNN know.
One second. This is not Fox O'Reilly show. This is Amy Goodman. Let me speak. Who are, you know, very much in favor of having people who are very much uniquely focused only on Islam. I mean, as it happens, the other guest writes on Islam without being trained or knowledgeable about it. If she would, she would know that there are many brave souls, free thinkers in the history of Islam who spoke out, and some of them died because they went against conventional wisdom. And they were braver against Islam, the religion. Many of them mocked Muhammad. Many of them mocked the Quran. And some of them lived with their heads on their shoulder. But she is totally ignorant about that because that's not her specialty. I mean, her specialty is polemics against Islam, and that's something very much appreciated in the United States. Yes, it is true. There are many media in the Arab world that have published grotesque anti-Semitic depictions and images. But these are the responsibility of the governments, and many of them are allies of the United States. And she is also, again, ignorant. Perhaps she doesn't know any Persian or Arabic to know that there's a big debate and there's a lot of condemnation about anti-Semitic writings that come out in some of those publications. But the issue here also is about something else. I mean, there is a notion in the West here that, you know, the issue is about the fact that Muslims ban depictions of the Prophet. I mean, which is true, even though in the history of Islamic art, if your guest knows anything about it, there are like tons of, illustrations in Persia, among other places, where Muhammad was in fact in very clear details depicted by Muslims at the time. For many today in the Arab world, and I mean, as far as the ranking of outrages, this is not something that outrages me. But you cannot, in the name of freedom of speech, deny the Muslims and Arabs the right to be outraged about something that offends them. But that's the whole issue, that we believe that offenses to Muslims should be defended as something that is in the name of freedom of speech. And there are many outlets today that are reprinting those same cartoons that are offensive to Muslims in the name of freedom of speech, while people do not treat offensive to other religions in the same manner. And it seems to me, if you insist on people having the right to depict in any way they want all prophets, as I do, I mean, I would love to have mocking of all religions, but people don't do that. People are very selective in what religion can be mocked and ridiculed by comedians and by cartoonists in many Western countries.
Irshad Manji, your response.
It seems to me that our friend here believes that the more angry you are, the more right you are. Boy, I certainly don't make that kind of an equation. And as far as, you know, reprinting and rebroadcasting these cartoons, I find it interesting that my favorite propaganda platform, according to your guest, Fox News, won't even go there. They won't rebroadcast these cartoons, and yet last night they were only too happy to trot out the viciously anti-Jewish cartoons that routinely appear in the Arab world. And you know why they believe they could get away with that? Because the Jews are not going to storm their offices. The Jews are not going to issue death threats against the journalists who are behind these cartoons. The Jews are not going to threaten the lives of people who carry American passports. Whereas we Muslims, we do, you know, have trouble containing our own violence. And anybody who denies that is clearly living in the world of theory, not in the world of reality.
Assad Abu Khalil, would you say this is an overreaction, what is happening?
I mean, first of all, I mean, it's not up to me to decide. I have my own sensibilities, and for me, I mean, as a secular atheist, you know, I would love to have people who mock and ridicule all religions together. But it is the inconsistency that's striking as well as the hypocrisy. I mean, she happens to mention the network where she is always pontificating about the issues of Islam, even though she's not trained in the subject whatsoever, is that Fox News have routinely talked about how they are offensive to Christianity because people don't say Merry Christmas during the season. I mean, we cannot in any way deny that there are sensibilities of Jews and Christians right here in this country, and that's something that is very controversial. You cannot deny that. And what she talks about, routine anti-Semitism, I mean, that is also a generalization about an entire region and about millions of people in the world. As I said, she is totally unaware about the many Muslims and Arabs who routinely speak out against anti-Semitism in the Arabic press, and these are governments that control the press, so we cannot say it's a reflection of society in general.
Where are the protests, my friend?
In general,
where are the protests? Where are the ordinary people pouring into the streets?
You don't have to appear on O'Reilly for you to know about them. They write them in Arabic.
You know what? You can invoke Fox News all you want, all right, in order to try to detract from the real issue here, but I challenge you to tell me, where are the ordinary Muslims in the Islamic world pouring into the streets to demonstrate against Saudi Arabia's policy to prevent Jews and Christians from stepping on the soil of Mecca merely because they are Jews and Christians? Tell me, where are those protests? Answer.
Well, if you read Arabic, which you don't, and maybe you want to learn it, you would realize that many writers and intellectuals have written about these issues, have condemned anti-Semitic writings wherever they occur. If they do not appear in certain demonstrations, it's because these governments do not allow the demonstrations.
Where are the demonstrations?
One second, let me finish. And there's another element here, Amy, in the story, which I think, I mean, I've written about it on my blog, which I think is important. I totally believe that these demonstrations have been instigated and have been set off by the Arab governments and Muslim governments themselves. These are corrupt, bankrupt governments that are very much aware of the anger of their people about Israel and about U.S. foreign policy in the region and about wars. And I wish people are much more angry about occupation and about oppression and poverty, as well about Israeli brutality against the Palestinians, which your other guests would not dare talk about, of course, because O'Reilly wouldn't invite her on that show to speak about that. But as it is, Arab governments realize that Denmark and Norway are easy targets to pick on, and that's why they are letting their population to let off steam on that subject. So there's hypocrisy going on from many different places on this very issue.
Well, Irshad Manji, let me get your response to that question of protesting on other issues, as Assad Abu Khalil has laid out. Where
I'm not
protests?
Sure I understand the argument, Amy. Can you reprise it for me?
Assad Abu Khalil talking about, you're saying, where are the demonstrations around government violence, around what is happening in the occupied territories, with the same kind of vehemence, Irshad Manji?
Well, listen, I mean, if you want to talk about the occupied territories, let's talk about that.
No, you
there
don't.
Is. Hold on a second, sir. Let me answer this time. There are, for example, groups called Rabbis Against Human Rights Rabbis for Human Rights, who do in fact organize Jewish protests against the occupation of the West Bank now and latterly of Gaza. But again, where are we Muslims in this? Where are the mullahs for human rights? Where are we when beheadings take place? Where are the mullahs for human rights when it comes to defending the right of Jill Carroll or of Margaret Hassan, the woman who overtly expressed solidarity with the Iraqi people, was executive director of CARE in Iraq, and was still assassinated? Where are we when it comes as imams and as religious leaders? Where are we when it comes to speaking out against honor killings, which happen at the rate of three times a day in Pakistan, and this according to Amnesty
Muslim
International?
Women.
We have a lot of introspection to do, and Mr. Angry Arab over there is angry only at the West, not at the Muslim imperialism against
Obviously, I haven't read my book on Saudi Arabia or others to know about my anger and how it's expressed.
No, because I'm ignorant as far as you're concerned.
I find it very interesting how many times, whenever you speak, whether here and elsewhere, you refer to yourself as Muslim. Personally, I'm a human being, so I do not identify with any religion, but you conveniently do that to try to lend credibility on a subject on which you have no credibility. But it seems to me it's very offensive to all the brave Muslim women in the world who speak out and who demonstrate, and some of them get injured, against honor killing and against the injustices, but you don't know anything about them. You bring
I don't know anything about anything, according to you.
This is not O'Reilly. One second, let me finish. It's not a monologue for you here. And another thing is, when you speak about some rabbis who are in favor of peace, of course they exist, and there are priests for peace, and there are Muslims for peace. But what is your argument here? You are trying to say that there are rabbis for peace, but they don't exist in other religion that is Islam.
Where are the mullahs for human rights?
Because there's some genetic incompetence or inequality, and that's because Jews and Christians are genetically superior to Muslims. I mean, this is your point, basically. It boils down to.
That's your insecurity talking, sir, not mine.
Well, politically, to Arabs and Muslims, and you wish that this genius that is exhibited by people who are Jewish and Christians would spill over to the Muslim world. That's what it boils down to, right?
That's your insecurity talking, sir, not mine.
I want to ask a question about the... I want to ask two questions. One, Asad Abu Khalil, you made an interesting comment about you're saying you think governments are behind the protests. Would you like to elaborate?
Well, I certainly believe that many governments, like the oppressive government of Syria and Jordan, I have noticed that the security forces have a long record of brutality and of torturing of people, have become extremely polite, and I've noticed the footage on the Arabic media, that they allowed them basically to proceed peacefully and to speak out, and in the case of Damascus, to torch down the embassy of Denmark. And I find that to be very convenient for those governments because they are very much under attack by their own people for being largely silent about foreign occupation by the United States and about oppression by these same governments. And this is an opportunity for them to let on some steam be expressed by those people, because Denmark is an easy country to pick on. And it seems to me, and they are organizing a boycott of Denmark when those same governments would not dare to launch a boycott of Israel or the United States, which have been responsible to more offenses against Arabs by virtue of occupations than the Denmark government is. And it is not responsible, I think, for cartoons that appeared in one publication.
Irshad Manji.
What Mr. Angry Arab there doesn't seem to appreciate or care to acknowledge is that in the past 100 years alone, more Muslims have been tortured, imprisoned, raped, maimed, and murdered at the hands of other Muslims than at the hands of any foreign imperial power. This is not to deny Western colonialism, not at all. It is to point out that colonialism comes in many shades and many colors. And if we're going to have integrity as human rights advocates, then we also have to stand up on that front. And that's what he seems to be forgetting.
The last point, the thing I want to say, if the question of integrity, you're the last person to speak on that subject, especially on the subject of religion, and especially here.
You love personal attacks,
don't you? We just have 30 seconds, but I want to ask about the continued publication of the cartoons, and I want to get each of your response to them. Irshad Manji?
I think it's very obvious what's going on. There are people in the West who very much enjoy the opportunity to provoke Muslims and to offend them further, and Muslims feel offended on this very subject. But it seems to me we should insist on the principle of freedom of speech and the right to offend people's beliefs and values. But it seems to me it doesn't take much courage to offend Muslims in Western countries, which is exactly the polemical career of the other guest.
Irshad Manji, we have 5 seconds. Your response to that question.
Yeah, bring on the cartoons, and let's remember that more Muslims are offended by the violence in the name of these cartoons than they are by the cartoons themselves.
We're going to end it there. Irshad Manji, author of The Trouble with Islam Today, A Muslim's Call for Reform in Her Faith, a visiting fellow at Yale University, and Asad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University, Stanislaus. His blog is the Angry Arab News Service. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hovda Kadush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. Happy birthday to Orlando Richards. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.